Hello, I'm Juliette Littman.
And I am Joe House.
Welcome to Ringer Food, the Ringer's new hub for all your food-related content. You may have known this feed as House of Carbs, and don't worry, that's not totally going away. We will be launching two new shows on the feed, and the first is Food News with me and David Jacoby. You may remember us from our days at Grantland. Well, Jacoby and I are back to go over the news, sample snacks, share some personal tales of food news, some global tales of food news. Who knows what else is to come? And House, what are you going to be doing?
Oh, my taste buds, my hungry homies, my culinary comrades, we are back. We've done it. Here to tell you that we are reigniting House of Carbs with a whole new slate of tasty episodes throughout the year. We are starting with a football fracas, a gridiron gobble fest. We're doing NFL playoff potluck featuring taste tests of the iconic food item or items of every playoff city to determine which city reigns supreme.
Ringer Food is starting up this Wednesday, January 12th. That's so soon. So be sure to subscribe on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Trello help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at theringer.com, and joining me on the other line, the snitch butler himself, it's Andy Greenwald!
Chris, as a TV show that you liked and I didn't once famously said, I guess time is just a flat circle, baby. 10 years on, we're back talking about the Julian Fellows verse. So this is a beautiful moment for our podcast.
This is like in a kind of typical Watch fashion. We didn't really anticipate this. It kind of came out of nowhere. I mean, we've been vaguely aware that our 10th anniversary was quickly approaching. Greenwald, ever the personal archivist, has like narrowed down that this pretty much is our 10th anniversary show, more or less.
Roughly, yeah. We finally figured out that we recorded our first episode on January 17th, 2012 at 9 a.m. at the famous Brill Building on Broadway. I think it's very on brand for us to actually miss our anniversary, not be sure of when it is, and just kind of have mostly a rando episode to celebrate it, except...
Or a Mando episode.
Ooh, look at... See, we still have it, right? Like, every time I think we're down, we still have it.
I think I've been getting better. I don't know about you.
You have it.
I think you peaked in, like, 14?
I peaked when we did the slap. I peaked professionally. I peaked personally when we talked about that show. I'm excited that we will be joined later by the podfather himself, David Jacoby, who is directly responsible for the creation of this podcast, and we will grill him about that potentially ill-advised decision.
Yeah, so, but before we get to David Jacoby, we're going to talk a little bit about Gilded Age, which is a very funny show to talk about for our 10th anniversary show. It is the new show from Julian Fellows, who obviously did Downton Abbey. Downton Abbey among the first shows Andy and I ever talked about on this podcast.
I don't know why, but we did. Yeah.
It's also notable that this show has been in development or production or some stage of creation since 2012 itself. It shows.
Yes.
This show has literally stretched the entire run of the Hollywood Perspectives podcast on the Grantland Podcast Network and The Watch on the Ringer Podcast Network. And then we can also... Do you want to talk about this Boba Fett episode first?
Yeah. Okay, fine. I mean, I feel like... Chris, I feel like I have my finger on the pulse. And I feel like our audience wants to hear about a Julian Fellows show that premiered a week and a half ago. But okay, fine. Fine. We could talk about the very surprising Star Wars episode that aired yesterday, I guess. Okay, so we are not fully... we haven't really been paying attention, that close attention to Boba Fett.
I've been paying enough attention to know that it's not my bread and butter. But
yeah, exactly. Continue. I don't think either of us love it. I think you guys, you listeners, have a choice to make here. We are going to spoil the nature of last night's episode, the fifth episode of The Book of Boba Fett. Frankly, I don't think it's going to offend anyone, but if it does, feel free to fast forward. The thing that you guys need to know...
How many great conversations have started with, I don't think I'm going to offend anyone if I say the following.
I mean, look, Neil Young left the platform. Okay? There's no one left that I'm worried about offending. It's fine. Just from one Spotify firebrand to another, like I feel like this is a safe space. This was so weird, guys, because the fifth episode of The Book of Boba Fett is the season three premiere of The Mandalorian. It's just fully a Mandalorian episode. I was trying to think of precedent for a TV. I mean, TV shows have been different TV shows within their seasons. Like Mr. Robot did an episode that was an 80s comedy with a laugh track, right? Or Station 11 almost reinvented itself every episode. There's precedent for that. But for a show to just basically be like, no, it's okay. Here, you do your show this week. Like their summer stock theater was so wild. And really, for me, it was noteworthy because it's kind of indicative of what just a bizarrely handmade project Star Wars for TV is. That's the thing that I keep coming back to. And yeah, we could talk about the specifics of this episode. We could take wagers. Like, I'd like to do an over-under with you of how many scenes Pedro Pascal was actually there for. I'm taking the under zero.
Your favorite things in the whole world.
It's so great. It's so wild. But anyway, they made a different show in the middle of the season, a show that we do watch. So here we are talking about
it. So I feel a little bit more ready to deal with this, Andy, because I watch Yellowstone. So I don't know if we've mentioned this, but in season four of Yellowstone, and this doesn't really give anything away, not only did Taylor Sheridan do extended looks in the first few episodes of the fourth season, a couple of like 10-minute like thematically linked, but otherwise completely random. It's basically like scenes from 1883. And then within the sort of actual like main storyline of Yellowstone this season, they had this character, Jimmy, who is really, really like below Woody and Cheers level, like in the ensemble. And they were just like, we're going to send Jimmy to Texas. And every episode is going to have like 20 minutes of Jimmy, but not because Jimmy's going to come back and like save Kevin Costner, or he has to go to this other planet to solve a problem and come back with the necessary transponder. It's like Jimmy's just finding himself in Texas.
Cool. Good
and
for
that,
Jimmy.
But that was like, I would say, honestly, Jimmy got more screen time than Wes Bentley and Casey Dutton. I can't remember the actor's name, but he gets like a lot of screen time in this season. So when I saw this and it was like, my guy Jin is back in the mix.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I guess like maybe this is a little Yellowstone-y. Let me ask you this. Had this Book of Boba Fett, this series, been called The Mandalorian : The Book of Boba Fett, do you think you would blink twice at a full Mandalorian episode in the middle of this?
And to be clear, I'm not blinking. Like when Boba Fett was announced, it was like stealth announced at the back end of the season finale of Mandalorian season two. And going by the Hollywood Reporter story, very few people, even within Lucasfilm or Disney, like obviously
Dude,
the executive
wasn't
level,
not when, like,
they didn't
I wasn't
know about
sure
it.
What I was shooting for half of the time I was shooting
yes.
Boba Fett.
And frankly, I saw some stuff today. The actress Bryce Dallas Howard, actress and director, we should say, she's directed on this show before, was saying, oh, she's directing some of Mandalorian season three. She probably thought she did. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like they are running a content factory in Manhattan Beach, the Favreau, Filoni, Rodriguez verse.
And they're always putting out lists.
Stuff's getting chopped up and putting in whatever.
Is this lightsaber green or blue? You know, like.
Wait, are you suggesting that they're doing charticles, like clickbait charticles? We can, when we get Jacoby on, we'll workshop that because that could be a bit for us. I think there's legs there.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, I think this essentially was an episode of The Mandalorian, and I was happy about it because that's an enjoyable show that we like, and here it was again. I thought that it was okay, so here are my just a couple takes. One, a few weeks ago, I was talking about Matrix Resurrections with you, and I was like, we're never going to see something this idiosyncratic and personal again in the era of big IP. That's not true. This is basically that. I was wrong.
Also shows how much stock our listeners should put your pronouncements going forward.
Oh, well, I feel like, you know, I think they're 10 years deep and me being like, I'm gonna watch that show.
Yeah.
I will catch up and get back to you. So I think they know the score. But I just mean, like, this is so weird. It's like someone opening a shoe repair shop at Disney World. Like, they are there, but they're just making their own thing, doing it at their own pace and telling the story in their own way. And I really respect how bizarre it is. I think that there were elements already with Mandalorian that you're just like, okay, this is a more successful, and obviously it's had two seasons, but I just feel like it's a more successful series, and it didn't reflect that well on Boba Fett as an ongoing concern, because the thrust of Mandalorian, get the baby. We have the baby, protect the baby, or go find the baby. And to do that, you have to leave Tatooine.
This is a cute baby.
Yeah, or Jesus Christ, look at this baby. Which, by the way, can't keep going back to that well. Baby Greedo is introduced in this episode. And, you know, Muppet Babies is successful.
Did Baby Greedo shoot first? But,
it's good. What did he shoot? A pop gun? Like one of those Go-Gurts.
Did you find the lack of the baby in this Mandalorian episode by any other name to be distracting? Like, did because like I think that that's one thing that we'll have to see in season three. I don't know whether or not Grogu will be coming back from Force Academy, where he's getting his master's under Luke. Does he come back in the mix? Is he still cute? Is he kind of have like the Jonah from Ozark growth spurt and maybe his voice changes?
It's an MFA program. It's a Master of Force Arts program that they offer.
Did you just come up with that?
See, this is why they listen. I'm bad on the stuff I'm supposed to be good at, and I'm good at the stuff that doesn't matter. It keeps you guessing. I thought it was a tale of two halves, this kind of supersized episode of Boba Fett that Boba Fett wasn't in. When you take away the baby, you were left with the first 20 minutes of this episode, which was weirdly violent in the beginning. You know, at first I was like, oh good, I've always wondered what a meat processing plant looks like in the Star Wars universe.
Sure.
And then it got super gnarly.
I want to know what a creative writing program looks like in the Star Wars universe.
At Force Academy, where they all have to read their work and then share it, but they all speak 10 different languages.
But what about like the one guy in the creative writing program who wants to write Star Wars fan fiction?
Yes.
Do you think everybody is like really bored by that in the program?
Yeah, and they talk about it when they all gather outside smoking.
Yeah.
To talk shit about it.
Can you believe this guy is still fucking right about Tusken Raiders? Oh, I mean, Jesus.
God, also, their backstory has been established now.
Because for them, sci-fi is like the plight of the middle-aged white professor, you know?
Whoa, wait, wait.
Because like if you're in Star Wars, sci-fi is John Updike.
Holy shit. Are you saying that in the world of Star Wars, Richard Ford's novel, Let Me Be Frank With You, the third volume in
that's
the Frank
like Isaac
Bascom
Asimov series?
It is, no, it's like Dune. Like it is the Frank Bascom sports writer trilogy.
Yeah. The dew on the lawns of New Jersey is the spice.
So the Denis Villeneuve of Coruscant. Okay. You're saying that he's breaking the budget to build a accurate root beer stand off the side of the New Jersey Turnpike? Guys, Kathy Kennedy, Lucasfilm, get at us. We solved it. So this is how we're going to Trojan horse like all the canceled authors that were important to us. Yeah. We're going to do them as Star Wars shows.
Yeah.
Christ, I love that.
Sabbath but theater.
Who is the Philip Roth of... I was about to like try to pull the Wookiee home planet, and I can't. I just feel like...
All the Watch Real ones out there, make me an Obi-Wan Kenobi poster with, like, Zuckerman rising like one of the suns over Tatooine.
Jesus Christ. Okay. All I want to say about this episode was that the first part of it, where Mando, like, slaughters some people in a slaughterhouse, and then is like, excuse me, Space Disco, where is your service elevator to the place where my people are hiding? which they just seem to do. It's just as consistent as like the people who did the plumbing in the Super Mario universe were like, every third one, make a portal to a flower dimension. You know what I mean? It's just like, it's in the plans.
Yeah.
So he goes down there and the lady and the other dude are there like melting
the
shit.
Armorer,
right? Yeah. And they're just like, you know, and they don't speak in contractions and they talk about their religion and they do this info dump of like history. And I am like, dude, I don't need another religion. I thought we left the Jedi stuff behind and we were just going to get gnarly with it. That part bums me out. And then the back half of the episode, it's like Amy Sedaris making jokes about like, you know, Jawas being as hairy as Alec Baldwin. And I love it. But she didn't make that. I'm just,
I was like, did Alec Baldwin?
I pitched that in the room as an alt.
Yeah.
Just so you know. So that part is still the part that I enjoy most. But overall, it just is a lighter and brighter feeling just in terms of like potential show to me than Boba Fett. And so it was probably smart to remind us of the slightly better show that still is coming and that exists, but it's just an odd thing. I guess just to say that like the Boba Fett fans are already the Boba Fett fans. The one thing that I wanted to add to it, Chris, the conversation was when I'm fascinated at the growing pains of converting a cinematic universe to a television universe in a television age, which mm-hmm. is to say in this episode alone, they just kind of toss off a whole bunch of like canonical, I guess so's, like there's commercial space travel where you have to check your luggage. Like that's not something George Lucas was like scribbling in notebooks next to Luke Starkiller. You know what I mean?
Like galactic, that's just red caps.
That's just a thing that that they've decided is canon now. And when you're building a TV universe and it's kind of annoying, you have to think about all those details. It's really weird to watch them backfill all this stuff. Or like the fact that X-Wing fighters are cops. In this episode, they're traffic cops.
Yeah, they're like that in Mandalorian, right? They like, they're you're speeding, you know, in the second season of Mandalorian, right?
And there's even a reference, and I'm sure the super fans who are also the Updike super fans who are, keep listening, I know you've opened up Photoshop to service your Lord Master CR, but there's a reference that Amy Sedaris makes where she's just like, everyone made a big deal about the Empire, but that was like 30 years. So it's just like they're having to decide these things that really didn't matter. Yeah. Before, right? And that's sort of interesting to watch in real time. But anyway.
So Ahsoka is going to be Filoni as well, right?
Ahsoka is full Filoni. That's like his baby. That's his character. And Mary Elizabeth Winstead just joined the cast, which is pretty cool. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about Gilded Age, which, you know, obviously brings us full circle. We started this podcast back in 2012 at Grantland talking about Downton Abbey. Julian Fellowes returns. Are you just
for
laughing?
Some reason? It's just so weird that we did that.
But show. Yeah. It was a big show. It premiered in like 11, right? And I think by 12,
it was a big deal.
Into it. Yeah. And I think there is a world in which the Gilded Age is a big show. I'd love to know how many people watched the first episode because there's a ton of TV talent, a ton of like just an absolute dollop of Broadway talent in it. But we'll get to that. But the pedigree is strong. It's Downton Abbey. It's Christine Baranski. It's Carrie Coon, it's Cynthia Nixon, it's like a period drama, a lot of things that appeal to a relatively broad spectrum of people who watch TV. I have no idea whether or not this is like a hit, if it more people watch this than Euphoria or less or what, but I think it's a fascinating show to talk about. So we're going to talk about the first episode. If you haven't got a chance to check it out, there's really nothing that spoilery in the first episode, but let's just get into it. What did you think of this show?
Well, I think you can't talk about it without talking about its bizarre and fascinating backstory. And it's baked into the question you started to ask, which is like, is it successful and what would it mean for it to be successful? So as you alluded to at the beginning of the pod, like this show has been in development for 10 years. Julian Fellowes, by the way, fascinating character. He is a landed gentry. Mm-hmm. He's like a baron. He was an actor for many years, including like in the bizarre movie that kind of traumatized me when I was a kid called Baby, which is about a baby dinosaur being born and it stars William Catt. Anyway, he also wrote Gosford Park.
Did he play the dinosaur or who was he in Baby?
You know, I didn't click through. Okay. I can't do all the work for you people. Okay. Gosford Park, which was fantastic and sort of his first entree into the world of upstairs, downstairs social life. Although I think he was born to it and lived it. He also, by the way, like does shit like he wrote the book for the musical School of Rock.
Oh.
So there are all these pictures of him grinning at red carpet premieres of the School of Rock musical in Chicago with his son Peregrine.
His name is not Peregrine.
Yes, yes, it is. It is a trip, the Julian Fellowes wiki.
Is it a Peregrine, anyway, a bird? Mm-hmm. Kind of bird? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, people have all sorts of names these days, okay? It's fine. People like birds. The origin story for the show makes sense, which is basically like, oh, that thing that's popular, let's do it again. And let's do an American version of it. And at the time, it was immediately jumped all over. Like, not only this is great, we'll get more Downton Abbey, but, you know, I think that this was still kind of a relic of an era when there was some trepidation whether American audiences would en masse commit to a quote unquote foreign show, even if it's in English. That was clearly not the case with Downton Abbey, and all those boundaries have fallen now anyway with foreign language shows and Netflix, et cetera, et cetera. But people thought that was a really exciting possibility. He even was teasing that maybe there'll be some crossover with Downton Abbey, because mm-hmm. do you remember Elizabeth McGovern's character on that show is American? And then people just kept asking him about it for 10 years. And in 2012, he's like, oh, interesting idea. In 2015, he's like, well, I'm knee deep in research now. The Gilded Age is fascinating.
And so finally, he also wrote a version of this show that was straight nonfiction, right? Or not nonfiction, but it was rooted much more in historical characters, and it was about the Vanderbilts. But then
yes.
felt like he was getting hemmed in by, well, this isn't the actual story of what happened to them. So he basically creates a Vanderbilt-like family in the Russells, who are at the center of the show.
And then on the sort of business side of it, it's equally fascinating because the show is announced as a project from Universal Television, which it still is. And it is going to be set, it's going to go air on NBC. This is a huge get mm-hmm. for the then head of NBC, Bob Greenblatt. This is going to be a game changer for the network. It then does one of the strangest peregrinations, if you will, a television show has ever traveled. It goes from NBC to HBO. I just don't think anything like that has ever happened. The reason being, I guess they say, is budget. Like, they just can't, NBC can't agree on spending X amount of money to have these massive mansions and these massive period sets, which is all probably true. HBO can do that.
But that doesn't, I mean, I know what you're saying, but isn't that kind of weird that NBC, Universal, Comcast, like this giant global megacorp, yes. is like, we can't afford to do something that little old HBO can do.
Universal is still making the show.
I know,
so
but
it is,
like,
Universal on HBO program.
Is that because, like, especially in the last decade, the margins or like the budgets for network television shows were a lot more like cut and paste? Like, we have like a sitcom, it shoots on this soundstage.
Yes.
Like yeah.
Yeah, and we have to deliver this amount of advertising dollars, and to do so, we have to have a turnaround on this schedule and a more amortized whatever. You know, I was just talking to a friend who was a director on Briar Patch, who's directing an HBO show, and she was casually mentioning, oh yeah, you know, we have a day of prep for every day of production, which is generally industry standard. So she's like, so 28 days for two episodes. So 14 days of each. And I was like, wait, you have 14 days to shoot
it's
an episode?
2 weeks of prep, 2 weeks of shooting.
For one
episode of TV, yeah.
For an episode of basic cable show like I made, we had 16 days. Mm-hmm. 8 days of prep, 8 days of shooting. And then if we were over budget another episode, you'd steal a day. So
yeah,
and when
you hear like Bob Odenkirk talk about making Saul, like it's closer to what you were doing than what HBO is doing, right?
Yes, although that's definitely started to bleed as that
right.
the Breaking Bad franchise became more successful. But anyway, so it, when you say time is money, it literally isn't TV.
Okay.
So it's not necessarily
just
can we rent
it?
It's
like,
not just,
yeah.
It's not just we can't afford to build the sets. It's that we cannot.
Because, you know, it's like, oh, you guys bought the Olympics. It stands to reason that you could make a fake
right.
mansion, you know?
Well, and they are still doing it, but they're doing it for HBO and HBO's timetable with HBO's financial investment and whatever.
Right.
So the crazy thing to me, though, is having watched this show, this does not feel like an HBO show by any metric. It really feels like something that was part of the let's scale up our content that happened, we were talking about it the other week with AT&T. Like, we need to produce more things. We need to produce more hits. It's also, I think, relevant that during the period when this jumped to HBO, Bob Greenblatt had gone from head of NBC to head of Warner and was one of the significant players in the launch of HBO Max. He was never in charge of programming at HBO, but he was very involved in the overall company. This struck me more as an HBO Max show than an HBO show, if that distinction even matters. And the number one thing that it struck me that the show was we really fucked up by not buying The Crown. I know this is an American show. I know there's a lot of dissimilarities. It's not a one-to-one. But in terms of we are going to be in the pocket of a comfortable zone for an audience that we don't usually service. This is what that felt like to me.
Interesting.
And all of this is to say, the Gilded Age, which as you said, is sort of about this moment in New York high society when the very, very old rich Dutch families were sort of aghast at the new money. People who had profiteered off Civil War or the railroads suddenly building garish palaces that now, of course, we all think are quaint and beautiful on the Upper East Side.
Yeah.
But and it was sort of a culture clash among the rich and the super, the newly super rich. So I by describing the show, I kind of lost my point of what I was going to say about it. But
well, you were saying how it's at once, it's strange to see it on HBO, but it makes sense because this is HBO's Crown replacement or Crown, like what they would have done. Had, you know, like this would be the thing that they would make to get that Crown audience.
Yeah, it feels like it does feel like almost a naked grab to get a certain type of audience, because I'll say after watching it, and I can't tell, and I'd love your thoughts on this, I can't tell if it's because Julian Fellowes is, you know, in his 70s and is used to making TV or things a certain way, or if this has been in development for 10 years or whatever, but there is nothing about this other than maybe the fact that they rented all of Newport, Rhode Island, save Taylor Swift's house, to film it, that screams HBO. They don't take advantage of any of the kind of like storytelling freedoms. And I don't mean like nudity. I just mean like you can be a little more complicated than that. Well, that's not what the show is.
So the one thing that's interesting about The Crown, which I love, is that it started out, it was, I wouldn't say shocking, but it challenged viewers' expectations because it asked, what if the queen fucked? You know, like it's like, what if the queen was this young woman who smoked and was trying to find herself in the world and was trying to figure out who she was going to be before she had this enormous responsibility placed on her during the Second World War. And, you know, her relationship to Philip, who was basically like this, you know, angry young man. And it's like this very like tempestuous drama that then eventually became, I think, a very like, very like precise retelling of modern British history through the prism of the royals. And then also now I think is now arriving at the sort of tabloidification of the royals that happened with the modern media. Mm-hmm. The Gilded Age, it's like, it's very, very, in this essay, I shall argue, ... And it is like from the first, like they, if you thought that like the log line for the show is new money against old money in upper class New York in the 19th century, they absolutely, like, characters say that in the show where they're just like, I am the new money in this town and I will not be ignored. And like the old money is like, we are the old money and they will never forget it. And I kind of enjoy its like bald sort of like, this is what we are. Like, just don't get it twisted. But that is actually, it almost feels like that is part of like the network version of this show, where it's like, yes, these looky-loos who might watch the first episode need to be hit over the head 100 times with the themes and ideas of what we're going to be doing going forward. And I think it kind of limits, to some extent, the performances of some absolutely generationally talented actors, you know, namely Carrie Coon and Christine Baranski, like where it's like they are really like parroting the opposing viewpoints.
The show is, and we haven't even talked about it, I mean, great cast. I really like Morgan Spector too, the actor who plays George Russell. I got really excited when I saw that he was playing the kind of the new money guy, because I was like, oh, it's going to be a show about a Jew passing in high society. I'm so excited. Then I realized, nope, they just cast Morgan Spector as a respected theater actor, which he is. And he's good. But I was kind of excited that that's what the show is maybe going to be about.
How many shows do you go into hoping that?
All of them.
Yeah.
That's why I bailed on Ozark. You know what I mean? I was like, this isn't Semitic. Okay. No Jews. Like, no Jews moving to Missouri.
You thought Julia Garner was like in a, like a shadow remake of Yenta?
Yes. My God. Greenlight that, you cowards. No, I mean, the show itself is almost claustrophobic. It's so stultifying, like in terms, not just the rooms or the corsets, but just in terms of the rigidity of the storytelling. And, you know, it's a bummer. I think there are pleasures to be had in it. You won't surprise our listeners to know that your boy here is casually reading an Edith Wharton novel by choice. So this is a world and a demimonde that is of real interest to me. What's, I think, interesting to note, I mean, look, I don't know how Downton Abbey was received by the critical class in England. I can imagine. I think that what is being was undersold in the development of this show was, yes, Downton Abbey is not exotic. It's not like you know, it's not set on a gorgeous island in the middle of the Pacific or in the hills of Tuscany. But there is an escapism element.
Does that mean the only things that could be exotic are White Lotus?
Or, oh my God, you're right. I just mean like the idea of like, oh, there's this, you don't think of British countryside in winter as necessarily as escapism, but there's an element of that without question for the American audience or the colonial audience, if you will. The other thing that I think is worth noting that makes this sort of challenging, but kind of interesting almost in a perverse way, is that, as I mentioned at the beginning, Julian Fellowes, he's upstairs. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. In his actual life. I don't presume to know his heart or his politics or whatever. I just mean, although he's in the House of Lords, so one could guess. But like, I just mean, he's approaching it. The main characters of Downton Abbey.
Hunting a fox, you know?
It's fine. There are too many foxes, right? You gotta thin the herd. The show is about the upstairs people. The downstairs people are scruffy and have their, Mr. Bates has his foibles, but like it's about the upstairs family, right? Fundamentally, that's where the show is rooted in its narrative. And the American story is always going to be about the downstairs in this, whether it is the people who are serving as butlers or maids or whatever, or it's the new money upstarts, or as the show very clumsily tries to incorporate, and I think it probably deserves some credit for trying to incorporate, although the results may vary, the Black American experience as well. This is not necessarily the canvas that I would turn to Julian Fellowes for illumination on. Mm-hmm. You know, so the introduction of a character in the pilot who becomes friends with, by the way, another Streep. Talk about content farms.
This
How many Streeps are there?
Flying under the radar, though. Because, like, you know, it's like it became known that the Gummers were Streep progeny. And,
yes. And so the youngest one
is going by Jacobson.
Yeah, that's a wild move. She was like, the Gummer name is tainted.
Do you think
right?
that when
like,
your kids grow up to become podcasters, they'll be like known as the Gummer sisters?
I think that they would be lucky to escape the taint of my legacy. So an actress named Danae Benton plays Peggy Scott, who is a Black American writer or wants to become a writer, and she befriends the niece who moves from, shout out Doylestown, by the way, Doylestown,
a lot of
PA,
Doylestown in this show,
to come to New York and becomes embroiled with the family, one of the families. It just feels like in a box.
The Van
because
Ryans.
This isn't the show that is going to tell us about, that I would look to. I could be wrong. But I don't know if this is the show that I'm going to look to really explain the post-bellum Black American experience in New York City.
I'm going to give this
you're
show...
You're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. Yeah, but it's not a breathable garment.
The Black experience in the show feels equally as wooden as several other experiences in the show. So
that's fair.
By that token, I'm going to give it a little bit of like room to grow. I feel like this is a show that... You know, we've kind of had this a couple of times. We talked about 1883 and Vigil. We talked about the first episodes of those shows. And I think, in general, we should probably try and be as forgiving as possible about first episode-itis. It's
for
rare
sure.
that you get a Mayor of Easttown or a Station 11 where you're like, oh my God, like this is going to be my favorite show. I can tell. There were a couple of things here I wanted to talk to you about, just like in the weeds of the show that I think are worth noting. First of all, one of the characters on this show has inspired me to now ask for you to refer to me only as Mr. Larry from going forward.
We'll have to rebrand, but I think we can do that.
Yeah, it's the Andy Greenwald of Mr. Larry, the watch. The font might have to shrink a little bit, but we'll just shrink your name a little on the title card.
I think that's fair.
Mr. Larry and Gladys play the brother and sister of the new money Russells. So I'm into that. Gladys played by Tysa Farmiga. I don't know if you noticed that.
Yes.
And then... that brings me to this sort of bench of the cast that they have. So apparently because of like shooting in New York and for a variety of reasons, the Broadway bench of this show, and this is like very, maybe this is too insider Belasco theater for everybody, but you like almost every single person you see here is like, oh, that's the star of the South Pacific revival. Like that's just Kelly O'Hara doing two scenes in this movie or show. And that's kind of awesome. I just wanted to shout out, I believe it's Donna Murphy, who is, watch listeners will know her as the Riding Shotgun with Edward Norton in Bourne Legacy.
Well, they would also know her as the original star of Stephen Sondheim's Passions on Broadway, right? Oh no, watch listeners won't know that is what you're saying. Dude, no, but for real. And they talked about this, and I think there was a Hollywood Reporter story about this, that like filming during COVID in New York City did have some advantages, which is right. to say that like Broadway was closed, so everybody was available.
Right.
So we're talking Audra McDonald is in this show. Michael Cerveris is in this show. Like the guy, the butler for the Russell family, very familiar looking stage actor, Jack Gilpin, Betty Gilpin's dad.
Oh.
Kind of fun. No, the cast is really good and deep. And it's just like, I kind of wish that the show was fun. And to that end, we love Carrie Coon. Carrie Coon is on the wall, but there's a little bit of a woulda, coulda. The show was originally, it was Amanda Peet. Amanda Peet was playing that part.
You read the lines that are on the page. I it's hard for me to choose.
I think that's interesting.
It's hard for me to choose between Peet and Coon. You know, they're two of my faves, but it's pretty funny. I did learn this from Carrie Coon's performance and from this character. Is that now when I start really like getting back into entertaining in my home, which this show has inspired me to do, I'm going to introduce people to every object in the house and talk about its journey to my home. So I'll be like, this daybed is from Joybird from the warehouse in Oxnard, where two gentlemen brought it, and it was quite an ordeal to get it through the front screen door.
I also really hope that when
my wife brought this throw pillow on a trip to Lisbon. I said we didn't have room in our luggage, but I was wrong.
A fact that I'm reminded of every time I sit on it. Next time we do video.
Remember when you said I couldn't fit that pillow in my suitcase?
People can't see it. We're on Zoom. Behind Chris, there's a wooden table. Next time I see you, I want that table groaning with shellfish.
Yeah.
I just want 8 dozen lobster on that table.
That is the sickest shit. Like, that is like, so Carrie Coon's character, Mrs. Russell, throws this big, like, welcome to society party. She's been basically like waiting. It's like her 8 mile moment, you know, like,
yeah.
And
yes.
She's been waiting to step out on the world stage for however, like 3 years. They've built this mansion. Everybody thinks it looks like shit. They think it's awesome. They got the architect there to answer any questions, because that's a classic 19th century party thing. Is like
awesome.
The guy who designed the house is hanging out being like, well, in case you want to know, I reference Versailles with this.
I want to do that at my house. That'll be my version of the show, where I'll be like, you may be wondering who misinstalled this lattice work.
Yeah. But you should just keep... go find a guy at like the shortstop, the bar down the street.
That's
like
the guy we hired.
Yeah.
Like you might be wondering why this doesn't keep the raccoons out. Well,
that's because
I know a guy.
This guy who looks like Justin Turner, but is not Justin Turner.
No.
So I really want to do that. Yeah. I mean, like, I think Julian Fellowes, for all of his accomplishments, I bet that this show gets a little bit more nimble going forward, is my guess. As like the characters get going. I think it's interesting.
It might be. I just don't know if there's something about the biography of this show, not even the biography of Julian Fellowes, that makes me feel like nimbleness might not be in its DNA. And I could be very wrong. There's just something that feels a little cobbled together.
When you look at Julian Fellowes, you don't think quick twitch ability, like just like instant reaction to whatever the cornerback is giving him, that kind of...
Well, I just, you know, I've been listening to a lot of sports podcasts on the Ringer Network, and I've been hearing Bill talk about how the thing about James Harden is he can still get a shot, but, you know, time and circumstance has robbed him of the speed.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? It just happens to all athletes, circumstance being a buffet at... No, and, like, he's 33, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, or whatever he is. Like, I think that quick first step might be often the thing to go. But, I don't know, it does... It accomplishes, this is where I wanted to end with it on the show. It absolutely accomplishes the goal that I think HBO had for the show. It definitely plugs a hole and attracts certain audience and fan base. But is that what HBO is now? And is that enough? And what is it, you know, where do we go with it? We don't know. We should say, because I rarely have the opportunity in content that we cover, a great job by Baranski.
Oh, that's true.
She is really doing a great job. She's of the cast
that
we mentioned.
You kind of skipped Good Fight, so you haven't been able to say it for nine years. Yeah.
And she gets the assignment. You know what I mean? It's not just that she's like funny and acidic and, you know,
well, she's been in
the
show pretty much for the entire, like, of its entire development, right?
The reason Downton Abbey, one of the reasons it worked was you had Maggie Smith just throwing heaters, mm-hmm. right? And that's what Baranski's doing here. And I wish there was more of that spirit in the show. A little bit of puckishness or fun would go a long way. And you'd think you'd be able to get it with the proximity to Broadway and Broadway actors. We'll see.
Let's end on a high note on Baranski. We're going to have David Jacoby come on to talk a little bit about the origins of our podcasting relationship. So Andy and I have obviously been podcasting for 10 years together now. There are countless people to thank over the course of that time. Everybody who's engineered, everybody who's produced. Shout out Tate Frazier from the early days at The Ringer. You know, like, we've been recording this podcast for a long time, and we do it because, like, we really love talking to each other. Obviously, we do it even when we're not being asked to by Bill. But yeah, like, do you have any, like, general thoughts you want to share with our listeners? I hate doing this sort of self.
No. I think that
I mean on a personal things, like a personal level. Like, it's, I think it's lovely that we've been doing this long.
I the thing I wanted to say was I think that it would be fun to. Because we clearly are not organized enough to have, like, thrown ourselves a party, but I think that it would be fun to, over this year or 10th anniversary year, like, or the next few months anyway, like, maybe have a couple other guests from the old days, or like repeat guests come back and talk about stuff. Maybe we could find some of our favorite segments, play back
on
some, I don't know.
ESPN's Pod Center.
Okay. So maybe we could find some of segments from the last 5 years of the pod, because the rest has been memory hold. But no, I mean, I'm excited to talk to Jacoby about it and to go back all the way back in the way back machine to the beginning. But, like, on the other hand, maybe we don't need to do too much of a celebration, because this is a celebration. This is my favorite thing to do twice a week. And I would be, as evidenced by some of my text messages, I would be very lost without it. So I'm grateful to you. I'm grateful to our listeners. I can't believe we still get to do this. It's pretty crazy.
I think it's hard for me to articulate what it means to me, just because it's such an extension of our friendship. So it feels like it weirdly personal to talk about doing the podcast. It's something that I'm very unselfconscious about. Like, I think we could just turn on the recorder and come up with something at least interesting to us. We're so glad that people have spent so much time with us over the decade, which is a weird thing to say.
Yeah, and I completely agree with you that we could always come up with something to talk about. I think it'll be interesting for people to hear our interview with Jacoby, because he disagrees and has been encouraging us not to just
do that. We always need whoever is producing or engineering us, you know, whoever it is, we always need that person. Like, it's worth noting that Kaya today, our 10th anniversary show, she was just like, can you guys get going?
Yeah, here's the thing that people might not realize.
You got to keep us grounded.
Here's a little behind the scenes hint. We are known internally as the bad boys of podcasting.
Yeah.
You know, like, we don't like structure. We don't like rules. We chafe against the man's expectations, or in this case, the woman's expectations. So we appreciate all of the people who have tried, and, you know, some have failed to keep us hemmed in, you know. No, for real. This is the best thing. We love doing it. I can't believe we get to do it. We're so grateful to everyone. We're especially grateful to Kaya for getting us started today and bringing us home week after week. Let's keep the party going. Let's not put a period
on
the sentence
now. We'll bring
on
David Jacoby. We'll be back on Monday. So everybody have a lovely weekend. And do you want to send us out with your usual sign off?
Chris, this is the beginning of our second decade podcasting, which will be our own Gilded Age. So happy 10th anniversary, Branskis. We did it.
This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on cars.com.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Andy and I are now joined by our original executive producer, the guy who saw something special in us when we didn't see it at all. It's David Jacoby from Grantland Days, now of ESPN, but also of The Ringer because he's doing food news with Juliette Littman. Jacoby, what's up, man?
It's so good to be here on this pod and see your faces on this Zoom because I've listened to countless hours of you two idiots talk about TV in a way that makes you sound really smart. And I often have to like stop the pod and remember like my personal interactions with you and be like, oh, no, they're idiots. Oh, yeah.
So we are so excited to talk to you, have you back on the show. And we want to do a little, Chris loves this, a little navel gazing, looking a little backwards, talking about ourselves. And in so doing, and I've shared this with you already, dug up the first email you sent about this podcast. And this was sent on January 10th, 2012. We're a much more innocent nation, as well as innocent people and younger.
Obama was just grinding. It was just like, Twitter was great.
Jacoby and I had 100% fewer children.
Yes. And, can I do a dramatic reading?
Well, I would love it because
I love it in my voice, right?
Because my favorite thing about it is that, as it turns out, we were one of a potpourri of podcasts that you were hoping to launch as the Hollywood Prospectus. It really wasn't, because the narrative that we've told over the years to like friends is, oh, Jacoby and Bill Simmons found out that Chris and I had been friends for many, many years and thought we'd make a good podcast. Actually, that is not the case. Not the case. Okay, you want to read this?
Well, a couple things I want to make clear. I am getting way too much credit for this already. It was very much you guys being friends and being great and Bill's idea and Mark's idea. I was just kind of in charge of the podcast network. But I'll take all the credit. You know what I mean? Whatever. And secondly, one of my philosophies back in the creation of the Grantland Network was, let's not give people podcasts or make people feel like they've got a podcast, because once they have a podcast, it's hard to cancel and or take away.
Yeah.
Look at us now.
Yes, exactly. And so what happens is you kind of soft sell it at the very beginning. And this is my soft sell sent Tuesday, January 10th at 1:42 p.m. I'm assuming that's West Coast time.
Yeah.
Hey, Chris Ryan, guess what? Andy and I spoke today and we decided that you decided you wanted to do a podcast in New York City the morning of the 17th. We also decided that you were really excited about it. You make great decisions when we make them for you. For real, I think the two of you would make an ideal pod pair as one of the duos that we are launching under the working title TV Podcast Umbrella, LLAA in parentheses. The others being Lasanti and Kang, shout to the gods, and myself. Incredible. And whomever is dumb enough to talk to me, aka Juliette Littman later in life. So Chris, first text Andy and be all, quote, what the fuck is Jacoby talking about, end quote. And then go back to me about if that day idea works for you. If so, I will book a studio in NYC on that morning, and then we can talk about what you two will talk about. Groovy question mark from the desk of Jacoby.
Incredible. Now, what was, just to be specific here, could you describe what was your...
I can't believe you're going to ask him, like, what was going through your mind in 2012?
No, not that. I just want to know, like, what was your assignment? Like, you were taken over, you were in charge of a podcast network that didn't exist. You were starting one for Grantland. And what were your goals here? What were your goals? And by the way, you're selling yourself short with the email because TV podcast is just one word away from The Ringer's most recent successful television podcast. So you're kind of a visionary.
Good point. I like this. We're calling it TV podcast.
That would have been like, so much better like naming, for SEO. Like
name, it would have been so direct. Like, yes. It would have been
it's
so
like
great.
Naming your dog, you know?
It's just but then like, no one's confused.
Yeah. Well, we ended up naming it Hollywood Prospectus, which to this day, yeah. I still hate. I still hate Hollywood Prospectus. It's a terrible, terrible, terrible pun and a reference, or it's not even a pun. It's a reference to something that I didn't even get and no one does. It makes no sense whatsoever. It makes me like feel like it's like, yeah, we're like a 1949 gold rushers that like watch a lot of Mad Men. It's like, okay, I guess.
That's a good idea. That's not Chris, but that does describe my aesthetic pretty well.
Yes. At the time, we were going to launch. We had the BS Report, big pod, great pod. I don't know if you ever heard of it. And then we started to expand the network, and we were going to do like a sports vertical and a pop culture vertical, much like Grantland had sort of like
the
main features and then the triangle and the Hollywood Prospectus.
Yeah.
So we were going to reflect that in the podcast. However, we decided to sort of like make a pool feed from which we would pilot duos, shows, play, experiment, and then eventually those shows that sort of stuck out, broke ground, cut through the clutter, would then get their own feeds and sort of quote unquote graduate. Now, none of that was shared with anybody, right? You know, the grand vision wasn't shared with the talent like yourselves,
right.
Because then you would feel pressure to sort of like get your own feed or whatever. But over time, that strategy not only bore fruit, but it's sort of like the blueprint.
Yeah, it's the model.
How networks work. Yeah, it's the model for how that. Now, listen, I can't, again, like, I'm not going to sit here and say that I created it, but it was something that we discussed, and it was something that I didn't see in the market before then, not that it didn't exist before then.
It's also really funny and nostalgic for me to remember what it was like, and you still know what this is like, but to work for the Walt Disney Company and ESPN, where you were like, these two idiots want to talk to each other about Downton Abbey, I'm going to book a studio at the Brill Building for them.
Yeah, like, the Brill Building, that's right.
Yeah.
Oh my
and
God,
we
I forgot
sat
about
in
that.
A studio, like in a, like a recording studio where they made like Be My Baby or something.
Yeah.
And Andy and us, Andy and I sat on stools like 4 feet from each other and just looked into each other's eyes. And
do you remember
like,
they had those stands like for like conductors use like
yes,
music
yes,
stands.
Yeah.
With
and you had like an engineer and they like asked you what you wanted for lunch. I probably spent like $2,500 on that stupid box.
That's what I'm saying. Like the engineers had just spent the morning doing ADR for the most recent Lorne Michaels movie.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And then these two dipshits walk in and they're like, the walking gate isn't very good, is it?
Lean period 24.
Let me tell you about this book I read last week.
So the thing that I wanted to share with you guys next, and I have not shared this with you yet, Jacoby, but later in that chain, you then gave us your tips and instructions. And I would like to, years on,
oh my God,
ask for how we're doing, because we love you and we respect you and your advice has always been good. I don't think we took it.
What?
And I feel like maybe there's still time to pivot. So, okay. So you wrote, this is January 12th at 1:41 p.m. Is that earlier than the first email? No, okay, it's 2 days later.
No.
Were you in the West Coast by then, right? You were in LA.
I think the first one was in June, right? This one was in January?
It was all January.
Okay, good.
You moved fast.
2 days later?
Because remember, you had been talking about it since June, but you didn't tell us about it. And Jacoby was in LA. Jacoby, this was in his peak, like, bike riding from mid-city to LA Live.
That's right.
Area, oh, yeah, no kids. Correctly. Yeah.
Jamba juice in one hand.
Yeah.
And they'd be like, let's have a meeting at Yard House. You remember? Like, yeah. It was just,
and,
just
oh,
just
leaving
beers.
The office to smoke cigarettes? Oh, God, I missed that.
But you fucked me. You quit right when I moved to Los Angeles. Like, I moved out and I was like, me and Jacoby are going to bond over smoking. And you were like, oh, yeah, I quit.
You were health conscious.
First of all right, you're still quitting. Okay. Sorry, Phoebe.
It's an ongoing thing. This is good. This is one of your tips, actually. You've just been embodying your David Jacoby's 2012 rules for podcasting. So first, you booked the studio.
Is this going to hurt my feelings? I feel like this
is
going to hurt my feelings.
No,
it's going to hurt our feelings.
Yeah.
You wrote, book the studio. January 17th, 9 a.m. Broadway Sound, the Brill Building. You music dork should be stoked about that.
True.
We still are. Some housekeeping.
I'm the best.
Here's my favorite. Some housekeeping. You should record the pod. Okay. Not wrong. By the way, this is essentially you
Guy
named the dog
right
dog.
Guy's like, absolutely. You gotta record
number
it.
Two. Number two from David Jacoby's tips for launching a successful podcast. Edit it together. Parenthetical. Take out fuck-ups, curses, sleep-inducing boring sections. Okay. Good advice.
Still haven't gotten there.
Send it to... No, definitely not. Send it to myself and some guy at ESPN who I don't think we ever worked with these specs. MP3, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Now some content hints. This is my favorite part.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm. See how we did. Number one. Have a fucking plan. 10 years in.
Nope. I have a plan. It just doesn't matter.
Okay. Number two. Have fun. Humor plays well in this space. That's accurate. Oh,
hey. No, that's true.
Hey, there you go.
Yeah. We're having fun right now. Yeah. Here's the one that has been ringing around in my ears for 10 years, and I have yet to listen to it. Get right into the content.
Seriously, that's the biggest thing for all podcasts.
Just say your names and get right into it. Don't give people a reason to bail on you. Start strong.
Thank you. I mean, seriously, guys. This is for all podcasts. If you're listening to this and you have a podcast, say your names, get into the content, start strong. I don't care what you had for breakfast. I don't care the train got delayed on the way to the pod. I don't care about your kids. I don't care about your clothes. I don't care about saying hi. I don't care about any of that. I'm Chris Ryan. I'm Andy Greenwald. And here's the stupid fucking show that I just watched.
Okay, I hear that. I do. It's just that a couple things. One, sometimes Chris's breakfast is interesting. We're catching up. We're good friends.
I've been having the same breakfast for almost the entirety of the run of this podcast.
It's never interesting.
Another wrinkle, I don't watch much TV. So.
Gotta get to an hour somehow.
We gotta stretch it. This advice is objectively good. We have just literally never done it.
Yeah, so, and that's fine.
Okay.
Next point. That we've started to become adept at like when we feel we hear the call of duty, like when it's succession time, when we know it's time to get in the mix. We cut out a lot of like, I had probiotic kefir on my granola this morning talk, and we get into what
did you
Kendall
start eating
Roy,
that?
What did Kendall Roy do?
Okay,
no, I mean, you guys do that with the big pods because I come in and out. My listenership of the watch is weekly. I listen to it twice every week, but during like the big moments and the big shows, I listen.
You're listening
times.
To the pod is week.
Yeah, that's what you were saying. And during weekly. those big moments, you guys do sort of like rise to the occasion.
Thank you.
It still means a lot to us. We still want your approval. The next one on your bullet point list: make fun of each other. Trust me. See, and that's what we were just doing with Chris.
Yeah.
That's easy.
Give him a little raspberry.
Yeah.
No problem. Okay. Last one. Keep it clean, tasteful, and not going to get Jacoby fired.
We did that. Andy and I are pretty chaste.
In Jacoby's, what's the opposite of defense? Offense. From an ESPN account, you sent this email, and after that, you then listed an example of something we shouldn't say that would get you fired, which I will not read 10 years later on the podcast.
Oh God.
I'll just say it involves your dog named Dog and things we shouldn't do to him.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Last thing. Now, a content question, presumably about the podcast we were about to record. What the fuck are you going to talk about?
Did this email even get a response?
The funny thing about going back to these old emails is just how much more invested in the podcast Andy was, because he's like writing copy for iTunes and he's like, what time do you gents want to record? But shall we gather beforehand? Like,
I didn't just write copy for iTunes. I wrote a blog post for Grantland, like with jokes and like embedded links.
I was a much more of a like jamoke back. Like I was like, this guy who like writes about soccer is also going to like ride shotgun with me while I talk about Downton Abbey.
That was my attitude. Well,
I need a little bit more of the original pitch, because like the first, like iTunes description of the show is like television critic and thought leader Andy Greenwald and Chris Ryan.
Oh my God. So you were basically like going to be kind of in a corner man role, like customato.
I don't know, Andy, these
butlers, I don't think they're on the level. What do you think?
Are they snitching enough? Or I don't know. I can't tell.
I think I went upstairs, they're going downstairs, pick a floor, you know?
Just to make something about you about me quickly, those emails are like a good indication of like me trying to get down with the Grantland gang. You know what I mean? Because I came from like a sports TV background and you guys were like these writers with like, you know, clever turns of phrases and read things and watch things and say smart things. So I used to like really try to be clever in my emails. You know, now, like, I have 3 kids later and a decade later, like, I really just...
Yeah, when's the last time you wrote an email? Like...
yeah. I made the mistake also, of showing... I showed Juliet my scent, like, scent box or whatever it's called, and she was so envious. She was just like, oh, my God, you sent 4 emails yesterday? I'm like, yeah, 4.
but you're a professional broadcaster now. You're on TV. You do this for a living. Your advice, you put into the world and it worked, right? Like, I don't know what Jalen has for breakfast. And you're on TV. Like, that's that worked. True.
Yeah, yeah.
That's good.
Get to the fucking content, Andy Greenwald. Do you have a plan? Do you have a plan for this interview? Did you guys write down any questions?
This is the plan. No. It's supposed to be a walk down memory lane.
Did you plan this interview? Well, can I say something very, very nice to you guys? I know that we joke a lot, but like, yo, this pod means so much to Grantland, and it means so much to The Ringer, and it means so much to so many people's lives. It's extremely popular, and it's really, really good. I don't listen to podcasts. I listen to like a few once in a while, and The Watch to me is an absolute must listen, and it's a great combination of expertise about the content and something that's so important in the podcast space, which I should have put in that first email. It's just chemistry. You know what I mean? Like, it's just chemistry. Like, you guys worked at Tower Records in like Philadelphia in like 1988 or
close
something.
Enough, yeah.
I
mean, yeah, it's
just like, excuse me, just like, yeah, our contemporary David Jacoby, 1988. Nice try.
I was being too nice. I'm sorry. I had to. But like, honestly, like this pod, I'm speak for all listeners. Like, this is a fucking go-to great podcast. And it's because you two are so smart and funny, and you can feel the love that you will never express for each other through every single minute of it. You know what I mean?
That's because like, you guys never told us to make fun of each other.
You'll never sit there and be like, oh, I love you so much, Chris. Like, this means so much to me. But you don't have to, because it's there, like, just in bits and pieces throughout every single fucking episode. And I love this pod so much. And you guys are brilliant and funny. And this is an excellent podcast. And I deserve zero credit for it. But that doesn't mean I won't take it.
Jacoby, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, our friend. So it was some of the best times. That weird little closet we had at LA Live.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
the three of us.
Those were some, that wasn't the three of us. Those were some of the most fulfilling, creative.
You were there. You would sit in the room sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. I was definitely there. That's because, you know, someone didn't show up or something. Yeah.
But also you, to be clear, when we talk about how you were the producer the way like Rick Rubin is the producer.
That's right. You know what I mean? Sit in the middle of the room, cross-legged, and just be like, let the drums flow. You know?
Yeah, like, you're like, I don't know what these knobs do, but I know what sounds good. You know what I mean? And I feel like that's standing spiritually.
There with a Jamba Juice, just kind of like dancing in the middle of the studio, just be like, I want to hear the takes. Just get right into it. Jacoby, we won't take up any more of your time, man. Thank you so much for doing this. Let's crush COVID and come back out and play Harding with me.
Oh, let's just get COVID, get over it, and then party.
Okay.
I love you both.
You guys are the best. Thank you so much. I'm honored to be a very small piece of not just the creation of this podcast, but also a listener, and to join you guys today.
Thanks, man.
Later, guys.
The King.